Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a fellow at Harvard University's Project on the Future of Diplomacy. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much.
And what is your sense as the U.S. pulls out of Iraq? I did speak with an Iraqi to get an Iraqi perspective on it. And of course, there's a lot of bitterness from the Iraqis about what's happened to their country. But there's also a sort of sense of they've been blaming everything on the Americans. And on the American side, there seems to be an equal delusion that they've actually done something good for the Iraqis. How do you come down on the post-mortem of this sorry chapter?
Iraq has an opportunity now that it would never have been able to achieve under the old regime. Whether or not the current leadership is up to the task remains to be seen. And so far, its immediate actions in the aftermath of the withdrawal of American troops doesn't do much to inspire confidence.
And I guess you're referring to the arrest warrant for the Sunni Arab vice president, Tariq Hashimi, and the whole Iraqiya bloc pulling out of the government.
Yes, that's part of it, but we shouldn't be surprised. There have been 300 leading Sunni Arab politicians who have been arrested. The Iraqi armed forces have sent tanks and parked them in front of the homes of some leading Sunni politicians. I mean, this is exactly what Saddam Hussein did when he came in. You know, first he went after political opponents, then communists, then Nasserites, then the Kurds. And Prime Minister Maliki is looking more and more like Saddam Hussein light.
And how come we didn't see this coming? Because I recall that that Ayad Alawi won the elections.
His bloc received the most votes, but he wasn't able to form a government.
Mm-hmm.
Did we see this coming? It's hard to imagine that U.S. officials were not aware. I think that in many respects, we preferred to be willfully ignorant. There was a campaign pledge made by Barack Obama, and he was committed to fulfilling that pledge. Unfortunately, that leaves Iraq in a bit of a mess, and now the U.S. doesn't have leverage over events there to influence the direction of the country the way we would like it to.
But apparently, Senator John McCain thinks we do, and that somehow Obama has dropped the ball. In fact, McCain made a very incendiary speech on the Senate floor a few days ago that was quite bitter and nasty and accused the president of basically being almost a traitor to American interests.
Well, that's going too far. Clearly, the U.S. needed to set a deadline as a challenge to Iraqis so that they could start governing the country by themselves. We have not been traitorous towards Iraqis. We didn't help them prepare for this moment adequately. We didn't foresee problems that would arise. And now we're moving forward with a big arms sales package to Iraq with F-16s and laser-guided bombs. And why does Iraq need these weapons? Is it a good idea for us to be selling it to them? There are a lot of questions about U.S. policy going forward.
Well, David Phillips, again, the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. It's pretty much established, isn't it, that the real winners of the Iraq war are the Iranians?
That's certainly correct. The government in Tehran wields extraordinary influence through Prime Minister Maliki and other politicians. It looks as though Iran is going to lose its proxy in Syria, and then it's going to refocus its efforts on Iraq to make sure that it's still able to exert regional influence.
So in terms of our politics, because it does seem that we're heading to some kind of confrontation with Iran, and the president was concerned about some of the language in the Defense Authorization Act that was perhaps too provocative in the sense that cutting off Iran's oil market or their ability to be paid for their oil might be seen as pushing them far to the wall. I believe there's some language in there that gives the president some flexibility. But do you see this situation as heading towards some kind of conflict between both the U.S., Israel, and the Sunni Arabs versus an Iranian regime that seems to be increasingly isolated?
I mean, here again, there already is a conflict. You know, the Iranian students stormed and ransacked the British embassy. There's clearly a conflict between Western countries and the EU as a whole and the regime in Tehran. If anything, the U.S. has been leading from behind on this one as well, trying to find some accommodation lest a complete boycott of Iran's energy supplies drive prices up. The EU has been much more forward on this. What's clear is that there's a unified view in the international community that Iran is a rogue regime on the verge of weaponizing its nuclear program. And if it makes that strategic decision, that is no longer an existential threat to the Sunni Arab world and to Israel, as well as the United States. It becomes a real threat, and then we have a serious conundrum on our hands.
So is it possible that given the irrational behavior, or the apparently irrational behavior, of the Iranian regime in setting loose the besieged militia to sack the British embassy, although there are some rumors that that's to do with internal fights between the head of the parliament and the president, it doesn't leave one with much comfort in terms of stability in that region. Would it be possible in Iraq, with no longer any American troops there, with contractors largely protecting the Green Zone and the Basra consulate being quite vulnerable, is it possible, do you think, in the near future that an Iranian-backed militia could make a move on U.S. interests?
That's happened repeatedly since we entered Iraq. The Sadrists and Sadr's fighters have been in active conflict with U.S. forces since 2003. So there's a pattern for that. And clearly Iran is behind Muqtadir al-Sadr's activities. So that represents a real threat. Whether or not there's going to be an actual attack against the Green Zone or against the U.S. consulate in Erbil or down in the south, I can't speculate. But the situation in Iraq is volatile. Iraqi politics is unstable. Iran is playing an extremely unhelpful role. It's stoking the flames of confrontation, and we need to be very vigilant. Things are going to get worse before they get better.
So given the emergence of Iran as a power in this region, which I think can be directly traced to the fact that the U.S. got rid of two of their enemies. They got rid of the Taliban on one side, who perhaps were more of an irritant than an enemy, although at one point Iran almost went to war with the Taliban. And then, of course, getting rid of Saddam, who'd been a sort of check and balance against Iranian emergence, particularly in what the Sunni Arabs refer to as the Shiite Crescent. Do you think there'll be an accounting on this side? I mean, I always recall how Brent Scowcroft warned about going into Baghdad for the very reasons that we've just mentioned. But clearly his warnings were not taken seriously. And I've always been puzzled why, since Brent is so close to former President Bush, why somehow Bush Jr. was not restrained in any way.
If you look back at the rhetoric in 2002, the advisors to President Bush 41 were all opposed to going into Iraq. You can find quotes from Dick Cheney when he was the Secretary of Defense warning against occupying Iraq, lest the country fragment and become a theater for Iran's interests. Bush 43 ignored all those warnings. The risks posed by the war in Iraq are now even more alarming, given the fact that we've withdrawn from the country and no longer have the kind of political influence that we had when there were troops on the ground. I also want to return to this issue, Ian, of weapons sales. If the rationale in providing the Iraqi armed forces with F-16s and 2,000-pound bombs and laser-guided bombs is somehow to act as a deterrent against Iran, we need to establish some conditionality on those weapons sales, that those weapons will not be used against other Iraqis, and that there's some kind of ongoing security cooperation between Baghdad and Washington, so so we're able to influence security events in the region. It seems to me to be an awfully risky affair, given Baghdad's history of turning on its own citizens and Maliki's propensity towards centralizing power, to provide him with those very sophisticated weapons that are more likely to be used against his own citizens than against Iran's influence or other countries in the region that might seek to do harm to Iraq.
So given what we're discussing here in terms of the reality of how much we have sort of created Iran as the hegemon there in the area, because the contrast is pretty stark when you consider Bush Sr. was able to evict Saddam from Kuwait and get the Saudis and the Japanese to pay for that war. And we were then reestablished, the U.S. was reestablished as the hegemon in that area where its economic rivals got their energy supply. Now it seems like the U.S. doesn't have much influence in that region, and they've tried to persuade India not to buy oil from Iran and gotten nowhere on that. I was just reading recently a book about Chalabi's influence in all of this, which raises the question of how foreign actors can infiltrate U.S. foreign policy and literally get America involved in its greatest diplomatic and military disaster in its history, all the while Chalabi being an agent of the Iranians. I mean, it's breathtaking. You've written about the post-war reconstruction fiasco. Does any of this still make you angry that these players have gotten away with, you know, the neocons plus their champion Chalabi have gotten away with so much?
I've written about Chalabi's role, and it's extraordinary how he was able to play the U.S. off against Iran. So does that make me angry? You know, as a U.S. citizen, having witnessed the death of 4,500 U.S. servicemen and women and seeing $1 trillion in treasure spent in Iraq, of course I'm angry about that. There's an interesting question that's now being raised by former Bush administration officials. They're trying to establish a link between the Arab Spring and the decapitation of the regime in Baghdad. You can see this kind of revisionism underway as a form of justification for the decision to invade Iraq. And I'm sure that this kind of discussion is going to continue in the years to come. President Bush has always said that history will be his judge. Well, history is now unfolding, and it's clear that Iraq and other countries in the region are turning against the United States. All of this should give us real cause for concern about using military action to overthrow regimes when there is no active rebellion underway.
So what explains then the neoconservatives' continued presence in the media, having any credibility whatsoever? Even one of the Republican debates was conducted with all the neocon architects of the Iraq War acting as elder statesmen. I'm just astounded as to why, when the record is so clear on how disastrous they've been. And, you know, I recall that the founder of the neoconservative movement, Irving Kristol, once said that neoconservatives are liberals who've been mugged by reality. Well, you'd think that reality by now would have mugged these reckless amateurs.
And the reality is that Iraqis celebrated our departure. Iraq's political leaders have turned on the United States. Our interests aren't being served there. Our security is diminished. Our oil access is also much less than that of other countries. So what did we accomplish after having invested so much in Iraq? Are Iraqis going to be up to the challenge of seizing this opportunity? There's no reason to be hopeful that the new Iraq is moving in the right direction. We need to learn some lessons from our experience in Iraq so that when we intervene in other conflicts, as we have recently in Libya, we're planning the post-war period and transitions to democracy more effectively. I guarantee you that Iraq will not be the last time that the U.S. intervenes militarily. We will see other instances when humanitarian intervention to stop genocide is a compelling cause, and we need to get it right in the future.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
Likewise. And we've been speaking with David Phillips, author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Postwar Reconstruction Fiasco. He is the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and a fellow at Harvard University's Project on the Future of Diplomacy. He has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.